Ben Fountain's novel Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk was a winner of the National Book's Critics Circle Award and a finalist for the National Book Award. It was adapted into a feature film directed by three-time Oscar winner Ang Lee. His latest book is nonfiction. It is entitled Beautiful Country Burn Again. In it, Fountain says twice before in history, the United States has been faced with a crisis so severe it was forced to reinvent itself to survive. First, slavery. Second, the Great Depression. And now where we are politically. In a sequence of essays that excavate the past while laying bare the political upheaval of 2016, Fountain argues that the United States may be facing a third such crisis, one that will require a burning of the old order as America attempts to remake itself. The new book is Beautiful Country, Burn Again, Democracy, Rebellion, and Evolution. It is published by Echo, and we welcome Ben Fountain to the roundtable this morning. Ben, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Very nice to have you on the program talking about this. This is a book that is reporting that starts pretty much at the end of 2015 and into 2016. What brought you to the point of, I think this is a fair word, alarm, of you wanting to look into what was happening to this country?
Well, I felt like as summer of 2015 moved into the fall and the election was shaping up in the way that it did, with Trump on the Republican side, yet really looking like the strongest candidate, and a real dogfight developing on the Democratic side where no one expected, I felt like we were moving into uncharted territory, and I felt like I was like a lot of Americans, I was confused and frustrated and angry and looking for answers, and the opportunity came along to write about the election for The Guardian. And I jumped on that chance. I felt like this would be an opportunity for me to explore in a hopefully systematic way what was happening and to dive into, you know, how we got to this point.
So what's a good starting point? And in writing the book, what did you feel the best starting point was to begin that journey of figuring out how we got here?
Well, I mean, the first trip I took for The Guardian was to Iowa just before the Iowa caucuses, and to get a firsthand look at the candidates and the kinds of receptions they were getting on the ground. But in a way, Joe, I feel like I've been preparing to write this book my whole adult life. The things I've been drawn to in terms of travel and reading and people I've sought out and the things I've written about, I've always been interested in power and politics and race and history and economics and large power structures and how individuals, you know, whether they prosper or suffer under the power structures they're living under. So, I mean, in a way, I had been reading and thinking about these things for all my adult life, and I just thought, well, if I'm smart and disciplined in my thinking and if I keep my eyes and ears open, maybe I can figure a few things out in the course of 2016.
One of the things that you point out, of course, is that this country has struggled, and as you labeled them, we've had two existential crises. One being the struggle over slavery, ultimately culminating in the Civil War. The second being the Great Depression. You make the point in this book that the historical and cultural forces that we are seeing now has brought us to what you believe is the third American existential crisis. What do we call it?
What do we call it? I don't think we're there yet, Joe, but it will probably be something on the order of an economic meltdown, such as happened in the Great Depression, and that we very much skirted the abyss of in 2008-2009. All those factors from the bust of 2008 are still very much in play. If anything, we're more susceptible to an economic meltdown. What we call it, I don't know. We could call it, you know, the third reinvention, the third revolution, or actually it would be the fourth if you count the original American Revolution. But what we'll be faced with is the future of the United States as a arguably genuine constitutional democracy. And I think we will be faced with a choice of, are we going to continue striving for that genuine constitutional democracy, or are we going to become a democracy, the facade of a democracy, where we have elections, people vote, we have an ostensibly free press, freedom of assembly, etc., but where in fact the power structure is controlled by, you know, big money interest and the people who finance, who have the financial purse strings of corporate structure, political structure in this country, the plutocracy. So I think we're fast approaching that point where if we're going to have continue with a genuine constitutional democracy, people, the population at large, is really going to have to be galvanized and activated in order to, you know, preserve their political rights and their economic rights. Right now, I think we're pretty beleaguered on those two fronts, but there's still a chance to salvage the American dream of equality for all.
How much of what we're seeing and the possibility and the facing of this third crisis is caused by the great divisions that we have? The great divisions that we have economically, the great divisions that we have culturally and socially, and of course the divisions that we have politically.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of government that the founders set up, in which power is fractured, the design from the Constitution was, as we all know, there'd be three branches of government, power divided among those, because the founders feared and mistrusted concentrations of power with any one group or branch of government. And I think what we're seeing is, well, because of that structure, for American government to do its job requires a good deal of cooperation among people of different political views, bipartisan cooperation. And in the middle part of the 20th century, for a good 50 or 60 years, we saw the fruits of that kind of bipartisan cooperation, where there were informal institutions and traditions that kept government functioning in a constructive way. That began to change in the 1980s and accelerate in the 1990s, where partisanship became more and more the rule, and obstructionism, you know, from one side of the aisle or the other. And that makes people, that makes the population at large, I think, you know, over time, very cynical and jaded about the political life of the country. For a democracy to succeed requires the active engagement of a critical mass of its citizenry. And so I think, you know, the more politics is broken, the more people want to turn away and tune out politics, which is exactly the wrong reaction if we want to salvage our republic. You know, we need to be pushing the other way. We need to be getting more and more involved in politics and the public life of the country.
Obviously, your story is a very American story. I'm interested in how this and how we fit into the rest of the world, because we're seeing this unrest. We're seeing, you could make a case, I assume, that while the numbers may be different, that the crisis that we're seeing in this country is being replicated in many, many spots around the globe.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question. You know, with the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, some smart people were saying, well, the end of history has come. Liberal democracy has triumphed. It's the paradigm for government around the world. And liberal democracy, along with free market economics, is ushering in a golden age. But what we've discovered in the nearly 30 years since is, you know, globalism and unrestrained free markets lead to tremendous economic inequality and dislocation and frustration among great masses of people. And that in turn makes people, you know, distrust the prevailing form of government in this country and in many others, like Western Europe, you know, which is liberal democracy. A critical mass of people do not see that type of government working for them. And so they seek out alternatives. They also seek out scapegoats. And that kind of environment is ripe for demagogues to come in and play on people's fears and worst instincts to gain power.
You have a chapter in the book called Doing the Chicken Hawk with Trump, Talking Fast and Loose in the Time of Endless War. Let us talk about that and this idea of, you say you'd think smart people would have learned a few things by now. Is it a war yet, or still the same damn movie that's been playing since 2001, that revenge and war porn fantasy where the USA kicks terrorist ass? Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, Libya, Syria, and on it rolls like a 15-year-old beater with 200,000 miles on the engine and balding tires. And this being the authorization to use military force passed by the U.S. Congress on September 14th, 2001. How much does that, do you believe, play into it? The fact that there are people, and I see, I teach, you do as well. I mean, you look, and these students that you are in front of have grown up, and there's never not been a war.
Yeah, and I think that's very dangerous. I mean, in a way, there has never, okay, the reality of the situation is, for the past 17, 18 years, the United States has been engaged in war, but only a very small segment of the population has actually been doing the fighting. And so for the vast majority of Americans, there's been a war taking place in the media, in the background of things, and we see it presented at halftime, you know, shows of baseball, basketball, football games, you know, with the pageantry of honoring the troops, et cetera, and a certain kind of war movie. But I think there's a huge gap between the reality of the war as experienced by the people who've actually fought the war and their families, and the reality of the American public at large. And no sacrifice has been called on the general population to fight these wars. Taxes did not go up. Instead, they've gone down. And I think it's worth remembering that the top tax rate during World War II was 90%. There's been, you know, not even a whisper of, you know, rationing for gas or any other kind of war critical materials. There's been no draft. And I think the only way war really becomes real to people is when they have skin in the game, when they or someone who they love very much is actually put at risk by the war. Then it becomes real. But until then, until we're called upon to make some kind of sacrifice, it will on some profound level remain an abstraction, in spite of the fact that we can see the most graphic kinds of images on computer and TV, you know, coming from these wars. But in a way, the vast majority of the American public has gotten a pass. And so, yes, we've been engaged in these wars all these years, but only, for most of us, only in a very superficial way.
And that superficial way doesn't have us talking about it and discussing it. And we went through the entire election cycle, really, in 2016 without debating it, discussing it, and acknowledging it.
Yeah, it was the only two candidates who were really questioning the hard military tactics of the previous 13 years were Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders. They were the ones who were questioning, okay, we've been doing this for 15 years. It hasn't worked. Shouldn't we be talking about alternatives? But the mainstream conversation was, are we going to have more of the same or much, much more of the same? And everybody knows, you know, the old definition of insanity. It's when you keep trying something that has failed and yet you keep trying the same thing. And, you know, I don't think we've faced up to the fact that use of hard military in the way we've done the past 17 years simply hasn't worked. But nobody is talking about alternatives.
You have a chapter in the book. I mean, we talked about division, and you have a chapter in the book called Two American Dreams. I mean, is that what it's come down to, that there's two very stark, different dreams that the American people have?
Well, there's the classic American dream, this notion of it doesn't matter into what kind of economic social class you were born into, if you live in the United States, if you work hard, apply your talents, play by the rules, obey the laws, educate yourself, go to work hard, pay your taxes, this society will reward you with a certain degree of financial security, and as well as, you know, the things that people need to lead a decent life, health care, readily accessible health care, a chance to educate your children, living in a reasonably safe neighborhood, you know, with decent housing. For me, that is the classic American dream, and I think it's one of the greatest inventions in the history of the world, where common people had a chance to, you know, a great mass of common people had a chance to live really good lives, fulfilling lives, no matter what their circumstances were at birth. Then I think there's another American dream, which is a kind of fantasy. And there's this thing I call in the book the fantasy industrial complex. And basically, it's that world that's always coming at us through our screens, through our computer screens, our cell phone screens, TV screens. And it presents, I think, a very unreal and idealized view of life, a kind of fantasy version of life, which actually is conflicting with the facts of life for a huge number of Americans in terms of how they're actually living their lives and what their opportunities are in life. And so we're constantly being told this is the most prosperous country in the world, the freest country. There's no country that has freedoms and the ability to succeed and prosper like America does, but the reality is very different. And there's a huge gap between the reality of the classic American dream, where people have had a real chance at succeeding and prospering and living good lives, and then there's the fantasy version that is actually coming true for huge numbers of people. But the reality is, working people in this country, middle-class people in this country, are really beleaguered, and they have fallen farther and farther behind over the last 35 years. And while there's been some amelioration in the last couple of years in terms of wage gains, you know, working people, middle-class people in this country are still, there is a tremendous amount of insecurity going forward. And so that's what I meant by those two American dreams.
Toward the end of the book, when you're writing about Donald Trump and Trump rising, you write about Republican leader Mitch McConnell, and you talk about his opposition to President Obama, and you say that the single most important, he said, the single most important thing that we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. And you write, burying Obama was the goal, and if bringing him down meant shredding the constitutional order, then to hell with 200 years of constitutional order. So we've been seeing that now throughout his presidency, but even now, when it comes to what were democratic principles for so long, meaning part of our democracy. And I'm curious as to, because you always also make the point in the book, and I also flag this, had the founding fathers wanted gridlock, they wouldn't have replaced the Articles of Confederation with the Constitution. So that's a long way of asking what probably will be my final question, which is, how do we go from where we are to where we should be?
I think we won't be sufficiently galvanized until there's a genuine existential crisis in the country, where we realize, where it's been brought home to us in this very visceral way into our own homes, that politics, as it's been practiced in the United States for the last 40 years, has led us to dysfunctional government.
Now, I apologize for interrupting, but and I'm just anticipating people screaming at the radio right now, which is, my God, didn't we see that yesterday? I mean, if this isn't our existential crisis, then what the hell is?
Well, we aren't there yet. I mean, we're watching it on our TV screens, but we're still able to go about our daily lives. Society as a whole, the system as a whole, has not melted down yet. And so it's still a thing on TV. It's still a thing that frustrates us, confuses us, you know, makes us incredibly angry. And we see that it's broken in Washington, but you'll know that it's really been driven home to a critical mass of people when the people rise up and say, all right, this has got to stop. We are looking for a leader and a political movement that is going to be an alternative to business as it's been done, especially the last few years in Washington. But, I mean, it's going to take a mass movement on the part of the people, a popular movement, to cure the country of the dysfunction that's taken hold, and it just gets worse every day. I mean, you know, I think we can look to our own history as a guide to the way out, and look to the way Franklin Roosevelt saved the country during the Great Depression. If you go back and look at the history, it's really shocking to see just how much doubt there was as to whether liberal democracy was capable of meeting the challenges and problems of industrial capitalism in the early 1930s. Liberal democracy was very much competing in the marketplace of ideas with fascism, communism, socialism, and Roosevelt found a way to inaugurate this new kind of liberal democracy that ameliorated some of the extremes and hardships that industrial capitalism imposed on the great mass of people. And he saved the free market system, he saved liberal democracy, and he did it by ushering in this thing that economists call the mixed economy, where government takes an active role in regulating markets, but markets are able to function and allow for capitalism to thrive. And the third part of the mixed economy is organized labor and collective bargaining that makes sure the common man and woman, the workers, the people who are making this great productivity possible, they get their fair share of that productivity, the fruits of it. I think, you know, the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt, obviously we are going to have to have something different, but the dynamism and inventiveness and moral center that Franklin Roosevelt brought to that crisis, I think, are great guides for, you know, our own time.
This book is very special. It has a beauty and a ferocity, and it is very, very important. And I thank you very much for writing it and for sharing your story with us this morning.
Well, Joe, I really appreciate you reading the book in this thoughtful way, and it's been a pleasure being on the program.
Thank you very much. Again, Ben Fountain is the author of Beautiful Country, Burn Again, Democracy, Rebellion, and Revolution. It is published by Echo. Ben Fountain, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.